This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, as promised, this week is the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference of 2022, this past March. This particular episode is a group called Fossil Free Lane County, claims that Northwest Natural Gas has the public pulling its finger.
Thank you for coming to our panel today on Fossil Free Eugene and efforts to build power and pass municipal climate policy in Oregon. My name is Claire Mone, and I am a PILC co-director, and I'll be moderating this panel for the Tribal Nations of Oregon. Nick Caleb serves as a staff attorney at Breach Collective, providing legal and strategic support to grassroots partners around the country. Before joining Breach, Nick served as the staff attorney at the Center for Sustainable Economy and an environmental policy staffer for Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly. While at the City of Portland, Nick stewarded the framework for Portland's 100% renewable energy policy, one of the most ambitious and comprehensive in the United States. Dylan Plummer is a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club working on building electrification in Oregon and Washington. He is also a co-founder and board secretary of Breach Collective and serves on the steering committee of the Fossil Free Eugene Coalition. And finally, Ame Okotie-Oyekan, her work rests at the intersection of environmental science, planning policy, and storytelling to advance environmental health protections for frontline communities and broaden representation of historically excluded communities in environmental narratives. Most recently, she worked as the climate justice strategist at Breach Collective. She currently is a land use and transportation planner for the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Great. Thank you, Claire. And my name is Dylan Plummer, UTM pronouns, based here in Eugene. And really, really excited to talk with everybody about some of the exciting work that we've been doing. And just also want to quickly shout out all of our amazing coalition members with the Fossil Free Eugene Coalition, and specifically a big thanks to Cascadia Wildlands, Beyond Toxics, Springfield Eugene Tenants Association, and the NAACP of Eugene Springfield for all of their work and support, and of course 350 Eugene. So just quickly, and I'll talk a little bit more about our coalition as we get started, but we are going to be talking about our work with the Fossil Free Eugene Coalition, which has now become the Fossil Free Eugene and Lane County Coalition, which is a very exciting development. And excited to talk about that. And a lot of this work was kind of initially seeded with our work, or with my collective work and the collective work of the coalition with the Power Pass Frack Gas Coalition, which is kind of spans across Oregon and Washington, and specifically some of the work that we were doing fighting against fracked gas infrastructure with the Jordan Cove LNG pipeline, which was recently defeated, thanks to a lot of awesome organizing from our friends down south and a really broad, great coalition. So to get started, I'm just gonna quickly give us like a background on the issue of gas and electrification, specifically in buildings, and then we'll hand it off to Emma to talk about our coalition's here and the work we've been doing in Eugene, and then Nick to kind of wrap us up with implications of building electrification and like the work that's happening in Eugene and across the state. So I think first things first, it's really important to dispel maybe one of like the foundational myths of the gas industry. That is that the gas that we're using in our stoves and our furnaces that's being transported in pipelines underneath our communities is quote unquote natural, when in fact, the majority of it is coming from fracking, which I'm sure many of you all are familiar with, is an extremely environmentally harmful and socially harmful process of extracting gas from the ground. This is a picture of a fracking well in Colorado where much of the gas that's being shipped through Oregon and to Oregon comes from. Again, there's been much said and a lot of organizing done around the massive impacts that fracking is having on local communities, that it's having on indigenous lands, and the methane that it's emitting into our atmosphere. So I think it's really important that we call it what it is. So not natural gas, but fracked gas or methane gas. And it's really important that we also realize that the purveyors of this gas are not our like local friendly utilities, as they might have us believe, but really just like another appendage of the fossil fuel industry, you know, in similar kind of terms as your local gas station, or even broader, you know, Exxon or Chevron or whoever. And the direct use of this gas in buildings is the fastest growing source of emissions in the city of Eugene and kind of the region broadly. So the direct use of gas, whether that's again in these gas appliances that we're talking about in homes and commercial buildings, is rapidly accelerating. And as you can see on this chart, the just use of gas broadly is the biggest driver of emissions growth globally in recent years, according to a New York Times article in 2019. And a third of that gas consumption in the US is coming from buildings. The American Gas Association, the national lobby for the gas industry, often brags that gas companies connect at least one new house to gas every minute, totaling over 560,000 gas hookups every year nationwide. This business is built on rapidly expanding gas infrastructure, which we know is with all of our local, state, national, and international climate goals. So the American Gas Association and the companies that it represents are not only actively working against our climate policies, but bragging about it in the national media at every chance that they get. So in Oregon specifically, homes and buildings consume nearly 43% of all energy and cause about one third of the state's climate pollution, the third largest source of climate pollution after the transportation and logging sectors. So this is a huge slice of the pie, and you know, especially as we've been working on 100% renewable electricity generation, our focus has been kind of taken away from the direct use of gas in buildings. But now that we've passed this 100% renewable bill last session, we're in a really, really great place to start taking advantage of our increasingly renewable energy portfolio and transitioning all of the direct uses of fossil fuels to electricity. And I'll talk about that more in a second. There's also really significant health concerns around the burning of gas, just like there's health concerns around burning any fossil fuels. And new data is coming out that's showing it's actually much more significant than we earlier thought. And like this graphic says, premature deaths are attributed to air pollution from buildings are estimated to be 18,300 annually in the country. Really, really significant. And most of that, those impacts are coming from nitrogen dioxide. And so homes with gas stoves have 50% to over 400% higher nitrogen dioxide levels in their indoor air than homes with electric stoves, which can lead to a myriad of different health impacts. 1 hour of cooking on a gas stove produces nitrogen dioxide levels that would be illegal if found outdoors. And I think the most shocking statistic that's come out of these recent studies is that children in homes with gas stoves have a 42% increased risk of asthma symptoms. And it's really important also to consider when we're talking about the health impacts, the impacts that are kind of inescapable for low-income households that don't have the funds to retrofit immediately. And we'll talk about kind of some of the bigger policy implications that this has. And then also the implications for folks who are tenants who don't have any ability to decide what kind of appliances are being used in their homes. So this graphic, you can kind of just see some of the different health effects associated with burning gas in buildings. And gas stoves are the kind of largest contributor to indoor air pollution, but our other gas appliances like gas furnaces and gas hot water heaters, they're venting their pollution outdoors. And it's still a really significant amount of nitrogen dioxide emissions that they produce. So when we're talking about indoor air pollution though, and burning gas on stoves, we're looking at a wide array of different toxic pollutants that are coming from this: nitrogen oxide, carbon monoxide, particulate matter, ultrafine particles, and formaldehyde being some of them. And some of the symptoms being brain toxicity, memory loss, asthma, shortness of breath, heart toxicity, increased blood pressure, heart failure, low birth weight, preterm birth, birth defects, and respiratory illness, among others. So really, really not something to kind of bat an eye at, or I don't know if that's the right expression, but it is something to bat an eye at, I would say. And, you know, just really significant effects. And this is just kind of an early stages of this research. And so we anticipate that as the research continues, they're going to continue to find increasingly severe impacts of from burning gas in homes. Gas not only affects our health, but it also affects our public safety. This is an image from a gas explosion in Portland just a few years ago that, you know, leveled multiple buildings. Thankfully, no one was harmed or seriously harmed, but there was just recently an apartment explosion in Silver Springs, Maryland, in which 10 people were injured, I think just yesterday or 2 days ago. These explosions are happening all of the time. And in fact, on average between 2016 and 2018, a gas pipeline incident killed someone, sent someone to the hospital, and or caused a fire and or explosion once every 4 days nationwide. Especially as our communities are increasingly experiencing the effects of climate change and drought and increased fire conditions, these extremely flammable pieces of infrastructure are especially concerning. And then additionally, in light of the Cascadia subduction zone quake that we are projected to experience in the coming years or decades, having this kind of large berth of explosive gas infrastructure winding beneath our communities is a huge hazard that we're undertaking. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about greenwashing. I'm sure many of you all are familiar with this term, in which companies that do environmentally degrading kind of actions are taking efforts and spending huge amounts of money on press relations in order to clean up their look, make themselves seem more sustainable, renewable, et cetera, et cetera. And the gas industry is not exempt from this practice. In fact, I would say they are one of the kind of industry leaders in innovating in innovations in greenwashing, specifically around their kind of promise of decarbonization and the technologies that they use to justify the continued expansion of pipeline infrastructure and the continued expansion of just the gas system broadly. So Northwest Natural, the prominent like primary gas distributor in the state of Oregon, and other gas companies across the country, represented by the American Gas Association, which I mentioned earlier, are relying on promises of decarbonization to kind of mitigate concerns about the massive impacts that methane and carbon from their products is having on our climate, and specifically talking about renewable natural gas and green hydrogen. Renewable natural gas, as you can see in this graphic here, is gas that's generated, often it's called renewable natural gas or biomethane. It's methane that's generated by natural decomposition, but generally is referring to biomethane captured from concentrated animal feeding operations or CAFOs, among other kind of already environmentally polluting industry. And then green hydrogen is also an increasingly kind of contentious issue that's being raised up by the gas industry as a solution to their climate woes, which is essentially the use of renewable energy to generate to power electrolysis, which generates hydrogen that can be like a quote unquote green gas. Though there are a lot of concerns, maybe too many for me to go into in this short time, but just knowing that both renewable natural gas and green hydrogen have impacts. There's health and safety concerns associated with them as well. And there's also concerns about availability and expense. And from everything that's kind of been reported on them and all the studies that we've seen, these are really scarce fuels currently, really expensive fuels that should be saved for very specific applications. And specifically around renewable natural gas, there are concerns from frontline communities about the impacts on public health, on climate and environmental justice, as we're seeing CAFOs expanded to generate this fuel. So a recent report from Oregon Department of Energy showed that RNG cannot even meet 1/5 of the capacity of current natural gas consumption in our state. And that's in a best case scenario. So realistically, they can't really meet even 5%. And this fuel should be saved for the hardest to electrify sectors, such as heavy industry, not for easily electrified sectors like residential and commercial buildings, which we'll talk about a little bit more here. Nationwide, even an industry-influenced study by ICF found that nationally, RNG could meet at most 16% of current gas demand. And like I mentioned earlier, RNG is produced from concentrated animal feedlots generally. And a study from the California Climate and Agricultural Network showed that increasing demand for new renewable natural gas would increase local pollution from animal agriculture. So we're seeing significant impacts being externalized on frontline communities from the production of this renewable natural gas, which is supposed to be the kind of pathway for these companies to decarbonize in line with state and national climate targets in the near future. So what we like to just say that renewable natural gas and green hydrogen are industry's red herring to prevent regulation and to delay measures like we'll be talking about in just a second for as long as possible, when in fact the cheapest, most equitable means to decarbonize is to electrify everything. So here's just a study from the New England Journal of Medicine, or a report saying that swift action to cut methane emissions could reduce Earth's warming by 30%. And again, natural gas or fracked gas is methane that's constantly leaking into the atmosphere, and when it's burned, it's putting carbon into the atmosphere. So now I'll talk a little bit about electrification and the benefits of electrification before handing it off to MA, talk about what we're doing about it. So in Oregon, you can see here, there's a 28% average emission reduction associated with a home electrifying in the state. So one of the highest in the country because of our high levels of access to renewable energy. And this is only going to increase as our state gets closer to its 2040 100% renewable goal. So we're already seeing significant benefits from moving away from the direct use of gas to using electricity, some of the best in the country. And again, this is only projected to increase. It also makes sense economically. A study by UCLA found that electrifying California's buildings over the next 25 years would create 8 times as many jobs as might be lost in the gas industry. And the Rocky Mountain Institute has done analyses in Oakland and Seattle, finding long-term savings for new construction of electric single-family homes. Electrification also supports climate resilience. So in Seattle during the 2021 heat dome, there was a study that was conducted showing that heat pumps were not only capable of maintaining comfortable and safe indoor air temperature, but also saved households money compared to the expenses of a dual fuel cooling and heating system. So a separate AC unit and a gas furnace. So as we kind of move into greater and greater climate chaos with the emissions that are currently in our atmosphere, it's going to be really critical that we're making investments only into mitigating the worst impacts of climate change by reducing our emissions, but also that we're taking measures to build resilience, especially in the most vulnerable communities, and investing in electrification and specifically in high efficiency heat pump heaters and that also offer mechanical cooling is a critical way to do this. And I also just want to quickly highlight the emergency relief effort, heat relief legislation that's been moving in Salem over the last session that I believe is now on the governor's desk. That is an excellent step in this direction for providing subsidies for access, greater access both to tenants and to homeowners to these high efficiency heat pumps that provide mechanical cooling. And So the specific policies, like while MA will talk about them more in depth, these policies are being adopted by cities all over the country. Over 50 cities in California have taken measures to mandate electric construction. Cities in Washington, including Seattle, Shoreline, and Bellingham have all now taken action. New York City was one of the single largest city in the world that's now taken action to mandate that new buildings be constructed all electric. The writing on the wall is that this is happening, and it makes sense for our climate, for our communities, and for our community resilience in the face of the impacts of the climate crisis that we're already experiencing. And it's just a matter of how quickly we'll adopt these new policies and how equitably we can make sure that this transition happens. And with that, I'm going to just quickly ground us a little bit in the just transition framework, and then MA can kind of take it away from there. But our work in Eugene and a lot of the climate work that's been happening across the state has been really informed by this concept of a just transition. And this movement generation graph or chart that I have here is, I think, a helpful kind of illustration of it, but essentially ensuring that as we move away from a fossil fuel economy, we're also addressing the systemic kind of issues at its core. We're providing protections for historically marginalized communities, BIPOC communities, low-income communities, and we're creating pathways for good-paying family wage jobs for workers in those industries. And we're working, you know, with these communities to develop a shared vision for, you know, a world beyond this extractivist kind of, again, fossil fuel economy that we've been stuck with for the past few centuries. So with that, I'm going to pass it to MA to just kind of talk a little bit about exactly what it is we're doing in Eugene and how we're trying to put this kind of broad concept of a just transition to work in our city and how it can hopefully translate to cities around the state and around the country.
Yeah, thank you, Dylan. And hi, everyone. Welcome. And thank you for joining us today. Everything that Dylan just said really illustrates the urgent need for a just transition and shifting away from this, you know, extractive, fossil fuel powered colonial economy to one that values all life as sacred and values bottom-up solutions. I'm really moving towards a just transition, using the power of frontline-centered grassroots organizing with the Fossil Free Eugene Coalition. So this coalition started about 2 years ago when the city of Eugene's franchise agreement with Northwest Natural, which provides our gas utilities here, was being negotiated. And a franchise agreement is essentially this contract between a city and a gas utility that allows the utility to have expedited access to the public right of way in exchange for a fee. So we heard that this franchise agreement was being negotiated, but not only that, it was being negotiated behind closed doors, so really undermining the democratic process and public inclusion. And that Northwest Natural, furthermore, was trying to put restrictions on the city's ability to regulate gas for the next 20 years. So we really had this urgent need to intervene. And so we really wanted to leverage these negotiations as an entry point for us to really dramatically shift our relationship with our gas utility and avoid locking in this harmful fossil fuel infrastructure for the next 20 years. And so we built this cross-sector coalition, really coalescing around this need for a just transition off of fossil fuels, off of natural gas specifically. And we have, you know, traditional environmental conservation organizations. We also have social justice, racial justice, environmental justice organizations, and housing justice organizations to really demonstrate that this is an intersectional issue. And so the best organizing is really centered around discrete demands that people can latch onto. And so our platform is centered around these three demands. First, we want to ban the construction of all new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city. Second, we want to mandate that our utilities, EWEB or Eugene Water and Electric Board in the city, was providing us with 100% renewable energy by 2030. And third, I mean, it's super critical that frontline communities, historically marginalized communities, are not shouldering the cost of this transition. So we need to be able to create a funding pathway that extracts wealth from companies like Northwest Natural and other polluters to be able to create a fund that can facilitate the transition to clean and renewable energy for low-income and historically marginalized communities. And so our coalition tactics involved like showing up at city council meetings. We had some in-person actions and protests, but I really want to uplift our media advocacy because as Dylan explained, the purveyors of the systems of oppression are master like marketing and communication strategists, and Northwest Natural is not exempt, and they have a very strong and effective narrative that has convinced people that natural gas is this safe fuel to use in our homes. So we had to come with an equally strong counter narrative. So we fed our work, that we were doing to local news platforms so that our narrative was being just as represented. And this really helped with raising awareness and support for our campaign. And this are just some of the few, news headlines that we had over the course of the past year or two. And what was really particularly effective was getting city leaders on record coming out with statements against Northwest Natural and the use of natural gas. This was a statement from Councilmember Serret talking about how Northwest Natural was extremely condescending towards the council, spoke to them like they were backwards country hayseeds. And what this does is it really helps paint Northwest Natural as a bad actor, and it's really breaking down their reputation in the public eye, and it just helps even more shift the momentum in our favor. And so one really big, huge consideration throughout this whole effort was how do we make this work equitable and inclusive? A lot of the policies that have perpetuated harm historically comes from not engaging these communities and asking them what their priorities are. So our strategy here was that equity in process can lead to equity in outcome. And with that, basically saying that taking the time to build trust with communities, asking them what their needs, what their concerns, what their priorities are, can lead to actions, initiatives, policies, that are reflective of those priorities. And just some lessons learned. So what equity in process can look like, and we are really gleaning these insights from a listening session that we held for communities of color just a few weeks ago in Lane County. First, that we really need to engage people early and request input for scheduling. And so this is thinking about people with childcare and work commitments or have limited transportation options if you're holding something in person. So really asking people early and getting their input about when's the best time, what's the best format to hold and convene a meeting can really make sure that that space is accessible for people. Second, you should really be upfront about who you are prioritizing, whose attendance you are prioritizing in that space. Because if not, it's usually just going to be the usual suspects that show up, folks that are already interested, folks that already know a lot about the topic. So don't shy away from specifically advertising that you want renters in the space, you want low-income folks in the space, you want communities of color in the space. Third, super important to use culturally responsive media and accessible languages and formats. So when you're, you know, putting your flyers on Facebook or Instagram, use, you know, people of color in the images and photos. And when you are communicating in your forums, make sure to have a translator there or have captions or subtitles just to make sure that that is accessible for people as well. Fourth, if you're not a group that has a history of doing social or racial or environmental justice work, partner with someone, with a group who is, and that can really help build trust and really build a bridge between your organization and the communities that you're trying to reach. And finally, it's super important to recognize that every time you ask a person of color or someone from a historically marginalized background to sit on a panel, give a talk, pick their brain, you're really asking labor of that person. And quite frankly, communities of color, specifically Black people, have had their labor stolen from them for the past four centuries, and we're not doing that anymore. So we really need to stop asking people to come participate and engage for free, and really valuing their lived experience as expertise. And so this can be providing stipends, this could be cooking, providing snacks at the event, just anything to show that you are truly valuing their time and expertise in that space. And taking these steps can lead to hearing their priorities and aligning your policy actions with things that will address their priorities and needs. And so what we heard out of this listening session is first that, again, the funding, we need to develop a funding pathway that extracts wealth from the highest earners and biggest polluters to be able to pay for these energy system retrofits and the transition to clean energy, because again, frontline communities have been paying with their life, with their health, with their humanity, and should no longer shoulder the cost of this transition. Second, again, highlighting the intersectionality between energy and energy justice and housing justice. It's really important to tie the gas ban electrification roadmap to increasing diverse supply and affordability of housing. Oftentimes there's an overlap between those who are exposed to air pollutants and those who struggle with housing stability and affordability. And there's sometimes this trade-off with where when you have affordable housing and housing that is accessible to you, as you're trading that off with poorly insulated buildings, out of date appliances and things like that. So it's important to think creatively about how we can incentivize the development of affordable housing that is also energy efficient. Third, and this one's really, really important. What we heard is that people are concerned about supply chains. They're afraid that as we are like rapidly electrifying and facilitating and accelerating this transition, we're not thinking about the interconnectedness of our work here and what is considered out of sight, out of mind in other countries where some of these materials that are going into developing this new clean, energy efficient infrastructure may be resulting from the exploitation of labor and land in countries in the global south. I mean, not just the global south, there are issues with mining, in Nevada as well with indigenous communities. And so if it's putting labor and land and people's health at risk to meet our sustainability goals here in Oregon, then that is not a just transition. And we need to be thinking critically about how we are not amplifying the inequities that already exist as we move towards clean energy. And finally, fourth, that people really want to participate in this work, but they need more support around being informed. So this could look like testimony training opportunities, more community forums. I'm just really, really building the capacity of frontline communities to engage in this work and supporting them in the ways that they need to be supported. And so we're taking all of these lessons that we learned, we're using them as language and materials as we're talking to council, as we're talking to city leaders and urging them for a just transition. And after the past, year, 2 years of doing this, council heard us and obliged. And in last November, they passed two really, really important motions that are really moving the needle towards this just transition, this future that we want to see. And so the first one is that the city council agreed to discuss the necessary local code changes that would be required to mandate that all new residential, commercial, and industrial buildings be fossil fuel free beginning January 1st, 2023. So that's just next year. It's a really relatively short timeline. But what this does is it's really the bare minimum. It's taking care of new construction. We're not digging the hole any deeper, if you say it that way. But now we need to shift in thinking about, okay, what is already in the ground and how do we transition those infrastructures? And that's the second motion, and that is to develop a roadmap to electrify all existing residential, commercial, and industrial buildings by 2045, with special considerations for engaging historically marginalized communities like renters and low-income communities. And a draft of this roadmap is due to council by this summer, June 2022. So again, it's just really encouraging to see council taking these measurable steps towards building this fossil-free future that we are fighting for. And with that, I will pass it on to Nick, who will talk a little bit about the broader implications of this work.
Just wanted to talk briefly about kind of a broader political and strategic framework for working on gas-related issues or fossil fuel issues in our region, and then kind of like move back down into Eugene and why things have been successful and how they can impact some of the other campaigns that we're working on in our region. So, you know, I conceive of the problems related to climate change in scientific and political terms. And the political terms are really important to grasp and start to work through. So for me, you know, the reason why we can't translate science into effective regulatory action at federal, state, local levels has a lot to do with the political dominance of the fossil fuel industry. They're huge amount of money that they can spend toward lobbying and toward campaign and toward advertising, and generally it's successful in kind of delaying action. We witnessed that at Congress just, you know, months back here and throughout our history of trying to do this work. You're also seeing a resurgence of the fossil fuel industry propaganda as it relates to the Ukrainian conflict right now, basically offering that the solution to these conflicts is more oil and gas extraction in the United States and serving more international needs with American gas. So, I mean, this is the context in which we're working in. And so, you know, part of our strategy, in addition to kind of raising the alarm about facts and what's happening and, you know, preparing for the worst, you know, and trying to mitigate harms, is actually trying to dismantle some of that political dominance of the fossil fuel industry. And in the Pacific Northwest, we've had some really good success through the Thin Green Line movement, which many of you, I'm sure, have participated in. And that's one where, you know, we have all these fossil fuel export terminals basically proposed through a region at the same time with massive amounts of collective carbon quantities, you know, greater than Keystone when we mapped them out and started to figure out what that carbon throughput would look like. And we had a regional sort of an organic, I would say, first activist-led and then later kind of NGO-stewarded and later political fight against these fossil fuel facilities that was wildly successful in just stopping basically any of this new infrastructure from being built. We learned in those processes a lot of tactics around how to deal with those types of facilities that are also very useful in now these kind of utility-level campaigns. And I'll talk about a little bit about more of that in a sec. But, you know, one of those strategies extremely important is just calling a spade and being able to talk about what a fossil fuel company is, what they do, the harms that they cause and the risks that you take on in our communities, and really push back on the kind of like, well, if we don't do it here, they'll do it somewhere else kind of argument, which is, I think, a false argument. There's only so many places that fossil fuel infrastructure can go. So out of those successes, now we have a lot of expertise, a lot of resources as a movement. And now it's time to kind of change and go toward another big piece of this puzzle, which is, as Dylan had mentioned up front, is our utility level gas and distribution and indoor use of appliances that are burning gas and all the rest for heating and cooking. It is a big piece of the puzzle. And the issues around fossil fuel industry dominance in terms of politics and messaging are very similar. These campaigns are also similar in that they're usually just, I mean, because of the monopoly status of these companies, there's usually one in a service territory, right? And so they can be isolated and talked about as a single entity, which I think is really important. So Northwest Natural in particular, which is, you know, my gas company and the gas company that serves Eugene, is in a place where they are very vulnerable. They're basically only a gas utility. They don't have a blended business model. They're trying to acquire water facilities all over the place. And, you know, I don't know to what success that's happening, but basically they're facing an existential threat with communities like Portland in 2017 saying, we want to transition to 100% renewable energy. And then those calls kind of being adopted in other parts of the state. And then later seeing the state legislature begin to adopt 100% renewable energy goals. They realized at that point that they were under a significant threat for their business model. And, you know, what they are doing in response to that is basically offering, they're doing two things. One is they're pouring way more money into communications, sending messages to ratepayers, you know, talking about everyone's like take away their gas stoves. They're also doing a lot more, I would say, messaging to confuse the issues, to try to confuse people about what might be causing air quality problems in their homes. And then they're also spending a lot of resources talking about how their solutions are renewable, quote unquote. You can just amazingly just pick and use that term for basically whatever you want. You can just attach it in your marketing materials to whatever you're offering. It's just a reality that we live in. So they're offering basically false solutions that are really, really high paid marketing campaigns. The result of that, in my mind, is not to actually implement those solutions. I think people that take a close look at them see that they're technically and economically infeasible. I think the whole point is just to delay regulation for as long as possible so that investors can ride off of the rents as long as possible while the utility continues to build out its fossil fuel infrastructure and get more and more people on that payment system to extract from. Because once that infrastructure is in the ground, it's much more expensive to get it out. So, you know, part of the reason why I think the Fossil Free Eugene folks are approaching things from the start of a gas ban is that you have to stop the bleeding at some point and say no more of this while we figure out how we're going to untangle the rest of the buildings from that. So, you know, the effect of Eugene starting this and I think really skillfully intervening into a franchise agreement discussion that was kind of going nowhere at the city of Eugene. The utility was very uninterested in voluntarily adopting restrictions on its own business model, which makes a lot of sense. They strung that out for a long time, but ultimately if you look back, it looks like they never really wanted to commit to the types of things that they put out on the table early on. So Fossil Free Eugene was able to kind of kick that door open and start asking bigger questions about where we want to go with our energy system. And that had a massive effect, not only in Eugene, but throughout the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, in my mind, it really did kickstart a lot of these conversations that were sort of happening under the table or among activists, but really hadn't been taken on in a serious way. And since the Fossil Free Eugene campaign kicked off, now we see communities throughout the Pacific Northwest and probably really soon state legislatures starting to really take a look at how we're going to deal with gas in the future. So it's been tremendously effective so far. It's really important, I think, in our organizing and strategy that we work together in networks and that we continue to link struggles in communities with struggles in other communities to tell common stories, to share information, to maximize our resources that we have collectively because of the power of the fossil fuel industry. And that's beginning to happen. So if you're a practicing attorney in Oregon, Washington, a campaigner or anything else, you know, talk to Dylan and MA and me and get linked into this and we can always help you get started up in your community too. And then the final thing that I'll say before we turn to questions is that in my sort of lawyer world, we've been doing a lot of research around what's actually possible to regulate gas at the local level. And did a panel on it yesterday, which I think will be recorded. So I'll refer, you know, most of the content of this to that panel recording. But the basic answer to the question is, if there's a will, there's a way. There are five or six intervention points that are available for local governments to either restrict or disincentivize the build out of gas. And then a lot of kind of planning pathways available to decarbonize homes over the long term. And so, you know, as we're at Breach Collective and our partners at Green Energy Institute and the Sabin Center at Columbia Law School are very happy to talk with electeds, staffers from governments who are interested in learning more about how those approaches could work, or advocates that are starting campaigns in your community. So, again, a lot of respect for the folks in Eugene that have really kicked this off for the Oregon conversation. Coming up in April here, there are going to be several work sessions at Eugene City Council where the city staff are going to tell us exactly what their plans are for moving forward with code. And so if you're a Eugenian, definitely get involved with that. Law students included, get out of the classroom, get involved with some of these campaigns, because they really do mean a lot. It's not just about Eugene. It's the whole service territory of Northwest Natural. And the way that we approach these sets the tone for fossil fuel campaigns throughout our region and also in the United States. So,
and I was hoping to just kind of chime in when really quickly to talk about this aspect of building power among like the progressive and like left movements in cities. I think municipal climate policy is a really great place to start because it intersects with so many other issues that we know are critical, whether it's economic or racial justice. And specifically, these building electrification campaigns offer a really great opportunity to talk not only about climate, but about affordable housing. As we know, you know, we're in a housing crisis currently. And so I think one of like the biggest highlights for me in this work has been getting to work really closely with the Springfield Eugene Tenants Association and support their efforts to pass increased renters protections in the city of Eugene. As a tenant myself, I think these are critical protections. And together we've been able to, you know, leverage our collective influence and resources to not just support one of these efforts, whether you not have to choose between climate or housing, but to instead advocate for policies that benefit both. And another point with the emphasis right now that we're putting on new construction, you know, as we're in a housing crisis, we desperately need more affordable housing. Housing generally lasts about 50 years on average, and gas appliances last about 20 to 25. So if we are investing in those pieces of infrastructure, it's really critical that they are renewable, that they're resilient, that they are ready for this new clean energy economy that we're building. And so just really wanted to highlight kind of the intersection here specifically around housing and climate that we see, and the opportunity that these efforts present for other cities and within our state to be building powerful coalitions, progressive coalitions, to be building long-term power.
Yeah, just really appreciate all the work that's being done. One thing I've been thinking about is how to reconcile this like urgency, this like the speed that this transition needs to happen, but also with what I've heard as heard being said as moving at the speed of trust, and like these communities that have been like historically marginalized, we really need to meet them where they are. So kind of like, how do we strike a balance between moving fast enough to stave off like the worst of the climate impacts, and also taking the time to really build capacity in the communities, build trust with them. And so I think that's just something that we're continually considering. And just as being in this space, just how important it is to like take care of yourself, like as an activist. I think they want us burnt out, they want us tired, they want us depleted, but really taking the time to like take care of your mental health and making sure that you are in the position to be able to be a good advocate, as well as something that I've just learned as I've been doing this work.
Thanks, you guys. That was wonderful. And we do have a few minutes left to answer some questions, so I'll go ahead and read you some. So first of all, one of our comments was pointing out kind of the complexity of figuring out future energy mix, pointing out that maybe electricity alone isn't the only solution, mentioning that the concept of energy density needs to be better understood, and that some newer alternatives like fracking come with problems of their own. Just pointing out that this is a really complex issue. So would you guys be able to comment on that?
Yeah, I guess I'll start on that one. I'm going to pass it around. But yeah, the question of future energy mix is one that's really important. And I don't think there are many different models that people are proposing, and there are benefits and disadvantages to different approaches. I think the way that we're approaching it in the moment is that we do have ready-made solutions for the building sector that are available technologically and financially feasible. And so this is a piece of the mix that's much easier to bite off than some of the other questions are. And so, you know, there are some drawbacks in electrification when you start talking about vehicles and like the amount of resources that you need from, you know, mining in order to satisfy that kind of stuff. I think it's really important from a justice perspective as well. Like, how do you access source materials? What are labor practices, et cetera, environmental impacts of mining and the rest. So it's really important to think about and keep on the radar rather than just sort of charging ahead on one path. But in terms of the, you know, stopping new gas, that one's pretty straightforward, and starting to chart these paths and at least begin community conversations, get the right principles in there, develop the community input that's gonna carry these processes forward over the next several decades. We can do all that work right now.
Thank you. Next up, what can non-Oregonians do to support?
I think the answer to that is just these campaigns are most effective when they're being run locally. And so looking wherever you're based, looking at your local government there and advocating for similar policies to set up a transition away from the direct use of fossil fuels and to, you know, simultaneously be working to clean up your energy portfolio.
Thanks. And we have time to ask one more question. Looking forward a decade or two, how do we transition the gas utilities to not existing? How do we sunset their existence without costing taxpayers for cleaning up financial and environmental messes?
I think that that's a great question. And you know, we want to be really especially sensitive. Like the one aspect that I've been really holding is how do we make sure that those employed by the gas industry have access to, you know, living wage jobs. And if there's need for job retraining or if there's similar areas where their skills, existing skills can be put to use. And so some of the kind of exciting opportunities there are looking at like district steam cooperatives where you retrofit or like you take existing gas infrastructure to provide like steam heating to neighborhoods through the use of electric boilers, which I think is really compelling and an interesting thing, interesting idea. And then additionally, there's been efforts in California to pair electrification mandates with gray water, like increased gray water infrastructure requirements on new buildings, which include like it's a great opportunity for like increasing resilience of buildings in the face of a climate-driven drought. And it also includes a lot of jobs for plumbers and pipe fitters unions, which are gonna be, you know, impacted by the loss of jobs from the gas, you know, industry kind of being transitioned away from. Yeah, that's kind of some of the thoughts I have around like specifically like the jobs and economic aspects and the infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, these are questions that we should be having on a pretty mass scale all the time, because there aren't really great answers for how you rapidly manage a decline of the existing fossil fuel infrastructure without some direct intervention or big financing. But, you know, I think that framework of managed decline is a good place to start from. Folks, you know, probably remember just a couple of years ago, the oil industry was on the brink of collapse when the pandemic started, and there were oil tankers kind of like, you know, piling up everywhere. And that was an opportunity where, you know, maybe if we didn't have President Trump or somebody who was like really pro fossil fuel in the White House influencing Treasury policy and the Federal Reserve, rather than kind of like handing a bailout and taking fossil fuel industry losses on the taxpayer dole, we could have actually insisted on conditions for phase out of fossil fuel infrastructure. And so, you know, there's a lot of financial mechanisms available at the federal level, fewer at state and local levels, but they still do exist. There are creative ways of kind of like bonding to buy out infrastructure and all the rest. Some of that may have to be taxpayer at this point. It's unless we are able to, you know, really go get money from fossil fuel polluters who are responsible for the climate crisis, which big legal questions are too. But, you know, I think a rapid decline means everything's got to be on the table at this point in terms of financing.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his Coke from Columbia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid. His lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.